Les colloques du Collège de France.
So welcome back. Now we're going to switch gear and we're going to listen to Stephanie Palmer, who's coming from the University of Chicago. Stephanie is a computational neuroscientist, theoretical physicist, and we'll hear about neurons and encoding in neuronal systems in the brain. Thank you, Stephanie, for coming.
Thanks so much, Thomas. It's an absolute treat to be here with you today and to get to talk to you about something completely different. Now for something completely different. So our group has for a long time thought about how the visual system processes information and how it sends that information down the optic nerve. And what we've been grappling with lately, sort of in, I'd say, version 3.0 now of the group, going from early studies to, dig into more depth, dig into the natural environment, is how a brain and a visual system functions in a complex world. So we are constantly bombarded with information and signals from the external world. And I'll give you an example of that. And it's a simple example. This is just a beehive. And we're looking inside. And hopefully as you're gazing at this, you can see that there are bees with different jobs. There's a lot going on here. And we could choose to focus on, and with our own inference machinery and cognitive machinery, study the regularity of the honeycomb, or think about the bees that are diving their heads in to tend to larvae, or think about occasionally a bee that comes in and does a little waggle dance, and how the information gets communicated out to other bees about where to find flowers. Important for us today here in France at this particular time are these bees. I know that some of you might know what they're doing, but does anybody want to hazard a guess? They're beating their wings really quickly because they're the HVAC system for the hive. So it's important for us, it's important for the bees not to die of heat stroke, and these bees actually help regulate the temperature within the hive. You might have also noticed a few bees, if you were looking very closely, that dragged a dead body out. There are also morgue bees. All kinds of things are going on in here. Now, our biological systems can't represent all of that. So the question is, what do you throw away? So I can show you that you can still get a lot from a video like this if we throw away nearly everything. So if I throw away all of the texture information that would tell you necessarily that these are bees, or tell you, you know, that it's bee Franck or bee Jean-Louis or whatever like that, then you still see that there's something going on just through the motion signal alone. So when our visual systems make summaries of what's going on in the outside world, we want to think about, for the rest of this, you know, sort of brief 30 minutes that we have together, to talk about what decisions are made sort of over, you know, kind of evolutionary time for what we keep and what we discard. Another way of saying that is we want to ask and answer the question as best we can, what matters to a biological processor? Because the way that biological systems compute things is that they make a transformation from those, you know, multitude of incoming signals that carry a lot of information to guide their own behavior. And so inside, you know, this blue box, because it's more understandable if it's biology than if it's a general computational device, because the elements that make that up have structure. And so everywhere from molecules to membranes to whole organisms, to collections of organisms. And then as those organisms become more and more complex, they can have...
Okay, I'm going to...
Oh, good. Okay. So I'll try to step away from the cables. Maybe I... Okay. Let me restart. Here we go. All right. So what I'm saying is that biological systems are made of interesting stuff. Okay. Let's just put everything up there. Maybe I got too excited about showing you lots of different organisms. But what we'd like to understand is how all of these different parts come together to make a computation efficient. So how do these different components of the system do some amount of compression? How does this work with parts that we might think of as squishy and maybe complicated and maybe even suboptimal? To create a brain that we walk around with that only consumes as much energy as like a 20-watt light bulb, whereas to train even the previous LLMs like ChatGPT-3, it took 1.3 gigawatt hours to train. So it's quite a lot of energy to do something in a non-biological fashion. So how do these biological systems win? So in the talk today, we're going to talk about optimal coding, and we can have a debate over lunch about whether or not we think biological systems are optimal, and I'm happy to get into that. And for us, we think about that in terms of maximal information transmission subject to constraints. And those constraints in biological systems are a multitude. We can think about energetic constraints. We've already been talking about size constraints, mechanical constraints. Even more important is to think about what the goal of the organism is. What is it trying to achieve? What makes it more or less fit? What is its behavioral repertoire that it's trying to evince with all of these component parts? So even something as well known and understood as our early visual system is not completely solved. And I think to understand biological processing, we have to go to the end goal of the system to understand how it senses the world. So the argument I'm going to try to make with you today is that what an organism does with its information sculpts not only what it computes, but how it computes it, and how it sees the world, how it senses the world. We're going to talk about vision. We already sort of had a little introduction just for us, our visual systems looking at the bees. And we're going to put everything on an information plane. This axis is the throwing away. And I'm going to emphasize this a lot. We're throwing away or compressing. So as we get more and more compressed, we lose information about what matters. But there's an optimal trade-off. And we're going to be able to compute, in some cases, this bound between how much we've thrown away and what we can pull out. And I would argue to you that biological systems might want to live in the armpit of this curve. Because they want to be able to throw away as much as possible while still retaining function. As external actors in this dialogue we're having with the biology, we have to guess what matters. And I'm going to show you some of our recent unpublished work where I think we're getting at how to discover what matters. So again, we want to know where that blue box lives. And it doesn't have to obey our wishes. It can live anywhere in the information plane, except for the fortune-telling part or the things that break the physical laws. So how do we put all these things together? So we're going to think about a particular computation that we know is mission critical to biological systems. We're going to think about prediction. And prediction is important because we're built of biological parts that have delays embedded in them. In a way, we could think of them as crummy parts, because if you ordered a bunch of neurons from an electronics catalog, you'd be very disappointed if they showed up noisy and laggy. But our brains all have that characteristic. And what that means is that what's happening now in our brain lags significantly behind the state of the external world. So if we don't compensate for delays, it can have big consequences. So this is my favorite tennis player. I always show Serena. I will keep showing Serena till the day she really retires. So here is Serena playing tennis. And if she didn't compensate for the delays in her retina, which are just 50 milliseconds, the delay from the light hitting her photoreceptors to that information getting transmitted to her brain, if she's returning even just a modestly paced ball at 100 kilometers per hour, she would be off by a whole meter as to where the ball actually was in real space. So Serena isn't looking at where the ball was, she's looking at where the ball is. And if we had an eye tracker on Serena right now, we'd see that she is actually looking at where the ball will be. And so for Serena to be able to do this, her visual system has to be overcoming delays. And it's something that we all do. You do not have to be a professional tennis player to have that kind of ability. If you want to get that ball to go somewhere that you dictate, you have to be a professional tennis player. But I would argue that that has more to do with your muscles than your eyeballs. And von Neumann noted this as early as 1956, where I'll quote him here. He said, "There is one important difference between ordinary logic and the automata which represent it. Time never occurs in logic, but every network or nervous system has a definite time lag between the input signal and the response." So again, we're going to think about how we trade off those constraints with having good, fast, and optimal behavior. So let me take you through a little bit of basic eye anatomy, give you some intro before we dig into the information theory math to see what we can discover. So we all know that we have a little computer in our eye. It's part of our actually central nervous system, our retina at the back of our eye. Developmentally, it's a squish between our peripheral and central nervous system that winds up in this really lovely compartment that gives us as scientists a really good window into how complex computations are shaped in the brain. So let's take a slice through. The anatomy of the retina itself already gives you the feeling just intuitively that a lot is going on here. This is the photoreceptor layer, and this is the output cable that's going down your optic nerve. All of the stuff in between already gives you the impression that this isn't a digital camera. This isn't a pixel by pixel representation of the outside world. Otherwise, there'd just be one cable from each photoreceptor to your brain. Instead, it's more like your smartphone. There's a lot going on to pre-process the signal and to make it understandable and usable to you. So if we take a different view of the retina, if we take a squished flat version of the retina, we see that there are many, many cells arranged in space. This is just a subtype of ganglion cells, the mouse on alpha cells, and they form a mosaic, and they basically map the external world onto the internal representation in your eye. So those cells have what's called a receptive field, a center and surround. They compute differences in space that let you see edges and things like that. So if we take this textbook picture, just the sort of cartoon of this receptive field, I can show you what the delay looks like. So if we flash a bar onto a single retinal cell, we can see that there's a lag relative to when we flash. The response is about 60 milliseconds in here delayed. And that delay is exactly what we need to compensate if we want to make accurate interactions with the outside world. Okay, so going back to the whole population, we can do the same thing in flash, but now we have many, many cells and they have their receptive fields. I'm just putting the centers here. That's the part of the visual world that they respond to most, are arrayed all across space. And that lets us, if we collapse across this y-axis, that lets us make a sort of neural image of what's going on in the retina. So if we collapse across y, we just have a 1D representation of when these cells are firing. And as a function of the delay, there's a little bit of response that builds around the central position where we flashed that object. Now, that changes when the object moves. And that's the essence of the key to how we're going to see how the retina makes predictions to help us overcome lags. So if the object moves across, then what we see is that relative to zero, that's relative to when the bar reaches the place where we flashed the bar before, that's what we call zero, that's time now, we see there's a lot of activity happening before the bar even gets there. And this is the essence of that predictive machinery. Whereas we would have been 60 milliseconds delayed, if the bar is moving in a predictable way, we see that there's anticipatory responses. And we can do the same thing if we play a moving bar movie to a whole suite of retinal cells. And again, this is what we're defining as zero. When that moving bar reaches the position where we flashed before, we can make the neural image again. And when we do that, compared to the flashed, this is the flashed neural image, which is centered as it should be around the vertical location of that flashed bar. When the bar is moving and it's moving from left to right, we see that the neural image has a bump that's anticipating. It's shifted over. Closer to where the bar will be rather than where it was when it was presented. So this is the kind of phenomena that we'd like to understand in broader detail and be able to probe and test. And so the kinds of experiments that we do in collaboration with Olivier Marr here at the Institut de la Vision are these kinds of things. So we play a simple stimulus, but not quite as simple as the ones I showed you. Not just flash bars and not just uniform moving bars. It's a bar that kind of jiggles up and down. This is just a trace of the center of the bar back in time. That's why it looks like a jump rope. We play this to the eye. We squish the retina down on a recording electrode array. And these are actual data matched to actual stimuli. So this looks like a cartoon, but Adam Klein, who was in my group, did a lovely job of making this animation with real data. So these are neurons. And when you see a black dot, that means that the neuron is firing a spike. So neurons are mostly silent in the retina, thankfully, otherwise we'd be hallucinating all kinds of images all the time. And occasionally they spike, and they spike in response to events in the outside visual world. This is exactly the kind of what's getting thrown away question we want to answer with these data. We want to answer, how does this population of neurons that are either silent in white or spiking in black represent not just the past of what happened before, but how do they anticipate what's coming next in the outside world? Okay. So to do this and to ask questions about prediction properly and from an information processing standpoint, we have to give the retina a choice. We have to give it both predictable and unpredictable motion. All of us here have taken basic physics, so we recognize this equation, some with horror and some with delight. This is just a damped harmonic oscillator, so we know how to solve this equation. This is the velocity of the bar, this is the position of the bar. There are some parameters that determine the restoring force and the drag in the system. There's also random kicks, so this is the unpredictable part. And what we'd like to understand is how the retina throws away the unpredictable part that makes this more like Brownian motion, but what it really is a damped harmonic oscillator with random velocity kicks, so a stochastically driven damped harmonic oscillator. We'd like to understand how it throws away the randomness and keeps the predictive part. So what we can do is take this kind of bar motion, and we can compute how much is possible to know about the future and compare it to what the retina represents. We do that by solving a bottleneck problem. This is the form of the bottleneck problem. We take the information, which is just a generalized form of correlation, between the spiking of the retina and the past stimulus, and we subtract beta amount of the future information. And we'd like to know both what the retina does in this case, so we need to compute eye past and eye future, and we need to compare it to the optimal compression. So these kinds of bottleneck problems are analytically tractable when we have the statistics like we do in that stochastically driven damped harmonic oscillator, which is why we picked it. So this equation becomes analytically solvable for the systems that we're interested in. And if you wanted to know more about that, you can check out some older papers, foundational work in information bottleneck theory, particularly this one from Galchechik. And then we can put on this plane our calculation of the optimal trade-off between throwing away information about the past, but keeping a lot about the future. And again, our question is, where does the retina live in this landscape? Because of the firing rates in the retina, how long we can record, and how many neurons we can get reliable recordings for, the retina gives us access to this part of the bound. So we're going to zoom in there. And when we zoom in, we can put on this curve, in this plane now, the response of the retina, its information about the past, and its information about the future. For single cells, it looks like this. So nobody should be too excited about single cells. They look kind of crummy. They look like they don't have much to say. But pairs of cells have more, and they particularly have a lot to say about the future. Triplets of cells have more, quadruplets, and so on and so forth. So that what we get, and this is something that's our bread and butter in the group for the last 10 years, what we get is a really lovely hugging of the bound, of the population response of the retina, to a particular prediction problem that we posed it. We asked the retina, how well can you predict what's going to happen 20 milliseconds in the future? And what we have been pursuing is how to understand why and how the retina hits this bound, but also how we can discover, rather than guess, what the optimization might be. So we felt pretty chuffed that we got this agreement between the theory and the data, but we'd like to understand better how this comes about. So what we've done is to try to analyze what the optimal trade-off between encoding the position and velocity of that external moving bar is if you want to do different kinds of prediction. So this is an entirely computational analytical paper from a few years back, where what we did was ask, given a prior on the position and velocity of motion in this world, so that's the blue curve is the prior. These are all normalized to the variance of the position distribution and the variance of the velocity. That's why it looks like a circle. We made it a circle. And we want to ask, if we compress information to make an encoding map of that external variable, there are different ways we can do that, and different ways of doing that give us different optimal information about the future. So here, if I compress across the x-axis, that's like I've gotten rid of noise in my x estimate. I've said I want to detect position, particularly here around, you know, say zero. So my uncertainty about x is getting squeezed out, and that's the yellow, my understanding or my encoding of the past. And then what I can do is analytically or in simulations track forward where that where motion that I detect there will play out, say 20 milliseconds in the future, and that's my future distribution. So it's rotated a little, but it stayed tight. That's if I'm overdamped. If I'm critically damped, so my damping coefficient is 1, then I need to trade off. I need to have not just position information, I need to tilt a little bit and represent velocity as well. That's what the tilt of the orange curve means. And then when I play that forward, my future estimate is still fairly tight, though I've lost some information. If I'm underdamped, things are really like sort of loosey-goosey, which makes sense. And I need a kind of equal weighting of position and velocity information. And as that plays out, and this is the best I can do then, with the same total amount of information, this is the same amount of throwing away for all three orange curves, then I get this kind of prediction about the future. What that gave us was a landscape of, given that I'm optimized for some particular world, how well can I adapt into a different one? So if I'm optimized to sit here, how well or how much information do I lose or gain if I move into a different universe? And all of these ideas are, in a sense, are computational and theoretical, and we want to use it as a way of asking where the biology sits. And now that we know the landscape of what you should throw away and why, we can ask what the brain is throwing away and ask what it's actually optimized for. So again, just to make this super, super crystal clear, we have a generic position velocity model, so that's our prior. We squeeze out some information about position. What we want to do is ask, if I squeeze out information about position or velocity, so I squeeze in the x direction or squeeze in the v direction, I start a bunch of points to sample there, and I look at where they wind up in the future. And then I can compare those balls, my kind of error ball in the future, from what I had to begin with, and I can ask how my information about the future is either optimized or de-optimized at different delays. So here's an example of a pure kind of position encoder, and I can ask how that ellipse expands down to the back to the prior as I'm trying to predict at delta t further into the future. I can change the orientation of that encoding ellipse, so I could make it a complete velocity encoder, and my information about the future drops substantially in this particular world. And I can do everything in between. And what I hope this tells you and shows you is just how that sort of trade-off between encoding position and encoding velocity works. So that's been sort of an introduction to the system in general and how we've been thinking about these things for the majority of time that we've been in the group. And this is now switching into the unpublished part, where I want to show you how we've sort of changed the script on all this. So we're still focusing on this world where we can compute things analytically for now, though at the very end I'll try to show you something where we have no hope of computing something analytically, which is more natural and perhaps more fun, but hold, stay with me for a moment. I mean, we're on solid ground. So we all feel comfortable when we can calculate something exactly and know that we have solid footing. We still have this stochastically driven damped harmonic oscillator, but we've dictated that everything sits at the critically damped state, so our damping coefficient is 1. And so we have one parameter left, which is this tau, which sets the timescale of correlation in the system. And what we're interested in are asking what different things you throw away and for what purposes, as a way of trying to discover what the retina cares about. This is just an example of position and velocity traces over time, and here they are in the position velocity plane. So you get a sense of this prior we have on where, in the phase of the external stimulus, where things live and how it goes around. We're particularly interested in motion reversals as well as constant epochs of motion, because we want to tie this back to things that we know real animals do, which is to have anticipation of where an object is going to be and to ring alarm bells when things reverse. When the world violates expectation and is surprising, we want to be able to react so, you know, ideally we don't get eaten. So in this world, so in this computable world that we've created, where our damping coefficient is 1, tau sets the time scale. Here's an illustration of that. Here is tau of 400 milliseconds to 25, and I think you can see in position and velocity, we have a higher, longer-term correlation here, and things have a different and faster and maybe noisier look to them at the short time scale. So what we're going to do is present these images, these kinds of movies to the retina, and we're going to ask if we can discover what the retina is encoding and what it is throwing away. Let's take a couple more seconds to think about this from the analytic perspective. So I want to show you a benefit of encoding velocity. So here what I've done is I've changed the encoding from being a position-only encoding in black to a mixture of position and velocity encoding. So here this is still the x-axis, and this is still velocity. So when I rotate, I'm including some squeezing out of the velocity direction. So here, with the black ellipse, I didn't care about it at all. I let velocity be whatever it was. I didn't bother to measure it. I threw away velocity. If we keep it, then we get some information about velocity, but we sacrifice a bit in terms of our position information. So it's a trade-off. And what we've done here is explicitly show optimal encodings for different delays. So as we look further and further into the future, since we don't allow fortune telling in the biological system or anywhere, as we look further and further in the future, because of the noise, we're going to be losing information. So this bound curve is going to collapse. So as we look further into the future, the bound curve collapses, but we see that it also, the optimal representation, the thing that's still the best we can do, rotates. So it's a little bit complicated, but hopefully you can see that information about the future is collapsing, and the optimal thing we can still do to hang on to that as much information as possible is rotating in the encoding space. I want to stick to this part. This is, again, the throwing away axis. And I want to stick to one particular part so we can compare apples to apples. And here I want to show you the benefit of allowing for some encoding of velocity. So here is the one that encodes only position as a function of now predicting. So we're stabilized ourselves to predict at short time scales, but how do we do at longer time scales? Well, we do pretty well. We sort of elegantly fade away at predicting the future stimulus, and that's the total stimulus, both the position and the velocity. And here, if we've been optimized to have the maximal amount of information, say at 300 milliseconds, you can see just barely that this curve is a little bit above the black curve here, though it's hard to tell. We've sacrificed short time scale information for the benefit of having just a squidge more at longer time scales. But the really important thing here to note is that if what we care about is predicting position, we sacrifice something at short time scales, but what we can see is that we are allowed to shift our peak forward in time in delta t. Now, we do that because our velocity information is not monotonically decreasing. This has to be monotonically decreasing, but the components don't. So by encoding some amount of velocity information, we get to move the peak of our position information around. The question we want to ask ourselves is what is best, or we want to peer inside the mind of the biology. And what we think is going on here is that if the retina wants to do the optimal job of doing motion anticipation, anticipating what will come next, then it needs to feed in a little bit of that velocity information, to sacrifice a little bit of short-term position information to be able to gain. So here is the real position of the bar, and here is the filtered position with this one that's best for motion anticipation, and I hope you can see as a function of time that the dashed curve is leading. And that leading is exactly giving us some intuition about what the retina might trade off. So in the broad sense, we're asking whether or not the representation in the brain is informative, efficient, or both, and informative about what? So when we're computing information, now this gets a bit technical, but I hope I've made enough of a cartoon of this that it's intuitive too. Information is just a difference in entropy. It's just a difference in the repertoire of things that we say, the vocabulary that we have in the retina to give a response, minus the residual sort of things that we say once we specify the stimulus. We can think of this as a noise term and this as a capacity term. And to increase our information about what's going on in the outside world, we can play these off each other. We can sacrifice a little bit of noisiness in the second term if we expand our representational capacity. Or we could say we have to keep our representational capacity fixed because, say, we have some sort of firing rate constraint. But we want to decrease our residual noise once the external world is specified. So what you see in this gradient is the ISO contours of the same amount of information. And so if we want more information, we can either decrease noise in the second term or increase capacity in the first term. And these are things that could totally run over when you just compute information. To dissect this, folks, particularly David Schwab and DJ Strauss, showed in their deterministic info bottleneck paper that what you might really care about is minimizing your response entropy, because maybe you don't have infinite capacity to say all the things with all the different spike rates you could. We'd like to understand how these things come together, so how we might live in this predictive bottleneck plane while we're also thinking about how much stimulus mutual information we retained. So we think about this throwing away as being a trade-off between possibly decreasing noise or increasing capacity. Those things are playing off each other. They give us like another aspect of this surface. So this is pure predictive information, but there's a whole other sort of potential trade-off going on. So I'll take you through a couple more, a foray into that, where we look now at the retina. And I think this is really getting at a question that lets this lift off of just computing things about retinal processing, and we can go to other systems with this. Because what we're trying to do, again, is to say there are lots of different things you could be optimized for. You could be optimized for something like, this is like an energetic constraint. How many spikes I fire, that gives me my repertoire, or how well I adhere to my behavioral goal. How do we discover that? So here again, our curves we've been looking at, this is the stimulus response relative lag. This is the full mutual information we have about position and velocity in those different worlds where tau was short or tau was long when we're jittering the bar. And this is the total information. This is when the cells spiked, and so they necessarily have to be reactive to their environment. So they're going to have a peak in their total mutual information that comes a bit before. If we look just at the position information, though, when we have an optimal encoding that's optimized for this long tau, we see that the peak of the position information shifts forward in time. And that's coming from having some velocity information. So this is the velocity information that can, again, be non-monotonic. And we can ask about how much information you have about the future and how efficiently you encode it with how much you've decorrelated your neural spiking. So we can look at sort of a decorrelation measure and our efficiency measure, like how many bits we have to say about the stimulus versus the size of our repertoire. So this would be more kind of efficient, and this would be decorrelating. What we find is that there's something that kind of optimized in a way both. We actually have the peak the peak when we are when we're most efficient seems to be at this intermediate time scale in all of those taus that we had. This was the very short tau, this was the very long tau. We find that there are places where either we have sort of an inefficient and decorrelated code, or we can have a correlated code that actually is efficient. So we can ask different questions of the system and we find different answers. We can also ask about this tau to max position information. As you can see here just by eye, it's moving past the zero into bona fide motion anticipation, and that might be optimal in a different way. And if we ask about just this full position velocity information as a function of tau, we have a peak that's at an intermediate time scale, an intermediate time scale that also happens to be a fairly correlated, where correlations are dominant in the retinal response. So what we can ask of the retina is, what do you care about? And we can find different answers depending on what we ask. I would argue that all of this says that perhaps the retina has evolved to be maximally predictive of motion that has that kind of statistics. So what we'd like to do as we're going forward is to go beyond the simple moving stimuli to something more natural, especially for the organisms that we study. We study axolotl, we study salamanders, for whom this is like a delicious buffet. And there's some recent work from Adam Klein, who I mentioned briefly, who's looked at this kind of natural environment and asked, this is something we cannot compute. We have no hope of analytics in that kind of fish movie, but we can ask about projecting into a latent space and asking about the structure of the latent space for different timescales of prediction and what the sort of dimensionality of that latent space has to be. So even when you have 100 almost 100 neurons, having an 8-dimensional latent space gives you about as much predictive information as you could possibly have. So I think I have said a lot, and definitely enough, to hopefully get you thinking about how we go from making guesses about what a biological system is optimized for to asking about what it's trading off in that sort of conception of optimality and how we discover what it does. And with that, I will take questions.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.